Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Hello, welcome to Business Game Changers. This is Sarah Westall. It is Memorial Day, and as a tribute to all of our soldiers, and especially our fallen soldiers, I want to re-air a show that I did earlier, like mid-2016, and it is specifically about the giving meaning back to our veterans and what we can do for people here. And we also talk about the struggles that they face when they come back to the United States, the suicide rates that are off the charts. The mainstream media is not talking about this. And so I really want to get this out as a tribute to them and as a respect for our veterans. This kind of information should really be out there. People need to know how much they're suffering and that they need our help. And they don't need our patronizing. They don't need to be treated like babies who need to be patronized, or a false sense of support when you do some kind of cliche statement to them, thank you for serving, and something that means, and it's not that that doesn't mean anything, but when you do it and you don't really have meaning behind it, and you'll hear Lynn Lauder is his name, and you'll hear his points on that and how veterans take that and how they know it doesn't feel sincere. And so it just, all of us need to wake up and understand what they're going through. And our veterans now are professional military. They're soldiers that are all volunteer. It's a different ball game when they're professional versus when we have a draft. And we're going to be talking about that as well. Being honest about what's going on and getting that information out there to the people and not hiding it is a tribute to our veterans. So today on Memorial Day, I hope that you listen to this show and that you, if you're watching it on YouTube, you share it with your friends and your family. If you're listening to it on national satellite, I hope you tell people about it. Tell them about my site. Tell them about the fact that you can listen to the podcast. And hopefully we can honor our veterans by exposing the truth and helping them get help. So let's welcome Lynn Lauder to the program.
Hi, Lynn. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Sarah. Thank you for the opportunity.
I really wanted to have you on today because there is something going on with our military that people need to understand. You know, we've been at war for a very long time, and our military is suffering the consequences of that. And we need, there's been a change over the last couple decades of how we deal with our military and how that's affecting those that serve. And this is something that you're fighting for. And I want to talk to you about that. But before we get into a lot of those details, can you tell me your background and what you've done over the course of your career as far as the military goes?
Sure, Sarah. Well, I was raised in downstate Illinois, farming community, and went out of there to Northern Illinois University to play football. And I was playing football. It was in my third season. But the war in Vietnam was heating up. We're talking 1966, 7 in that era. And a lot of my friends from a small high school I went to were in the military, had gone or were going or were in Vietnam. And frankly, I felt I didn't feel good about the fact that I was taking a time out in college. You could, back in that day, you could get a deferment if you were in college. And I thought, no, this isn't right. I enlisted, went to Marine Corps, an enlisted Marine, went through San Diego. And then because I had 2 years of college, they directed me. I was encouraged to apply for a commissioning program, and I was commissioned. I went to Vietnam. I was served in 1st Force Reconnaissance Company. That is a special operations unit, six-man teams. We operated far from the closest enemy or closest friendly forces, turning the table on the North Vietnamese out near the Laotian border, those kinds of things.
And that's like the Navy SEALs, but in your unit, right?
Precisely. In the Navy, the Special Operations Unit, people well know are the SEALs. The Army, the pinnacle unit are the is Delta. And in the Marine Corps, it's the Reconnaissance Marines. Force Reconnaissance in my day, now it's called SOCOM, but those people. These are your
best trained, the best military people we have.
These are the most elite fighting units out there. Yes.
And you were one of them.
I was fortunate enough to have done so, met and served with some outstanding Marines, was fortunate enough to survive and get back. And at any rate, long story short, Sarah, I stayed in the Marine Corps for 16 years, 10 years in the infantry, went back to college, finished an undergraduate degree as a Marine at the University of Illinois, and then later on decided I wanted to be an attorney. Why? I have no earthly idea. I do, of course. But I went to law school at DePaul University, got a law degree, and then my last few years in the Marine Corps, I served as a trial lawyer, both on the prosecution and the defense side. Got out, was a trial lawyer for about 20 years, wanted to get over in business. I was general counsel for mailboxes, et cetera, California, a large franchise operation. I had a chance to be the chief operating officer for Colt Firearms and in West Hartford, Connecticut, and did that. And I've run some other companies, had a chance to go, an opportunity to go and stand up a veterans program a few years ago at a university called the University of Central Missouri. And that was a very cathartic experience for me, Sarah. It was there that I kind of dusted off my Vietnam brain, got deep into the lives of some outstanding veterans that were on campus there, trying to find their lane in life and what they were going to do now, post active duty. And from that, I decided I really wanted to do what I could do at this point in my life to help veterans find their path. And so I stood up a 501c4 called One Vet at a Time. We are promoting and advocating for entrepreneurial opportunities for veterans so that they can basically be their own boss, if you will. And that kind of brings you up to speed right now with what I've been doing for the last 3 years, and that is as the CEO of One Vet at a Time.
Well, let's talk about what the military is going through, the whole problem that we have right now and the realities of what's going on. But let's start with what differs from today's veterans than those of past wars, because we are dealing with things differently now. So what's different?
Well, a couple things. The reality of what happens with veterans when they go to combat and fight, while the implements and the tools of war have changed, the experience is the same. The challenges, the things that they experience that you wouldn't want anyone to experience if given a choice, that is the same. Now, the way that we go to war has changed dramatically since the advent of the all-volunteer military. At the close of the Vietnam War, there was a lot of controversy about our military. The military was not held in good esteem by the American public. A lot of the anger and frustration of the Vietnam War was taken out on those that had the least influence in the matter, and that was those people that were in uniform, just trying to serve, do their job, and then come on home, if you will. So we started into this notion about the all-volunteer military. Less than 0.5% of our population now serve in the military. And there are consequences to that, Sarah. And the consequences are that a great deal, the majority of America is insulated from the sacrifice, the challenges, and the tragedies that can ensue when we put people into circumstances where they have to fight and endure some of the most challenging circumstances a human being could ever go through. We now find ourselves since 9/11, we're at war now, continuing at war. I think we're now in our 14th, perhaps 15th year. You remember in Vietnam, we were there 9 years, and the mantra was out in the streets, you know, with the protesters, no more Vietnams. Well, here we are in our 14th, 15th year or longer, and you don't see anybody out in the streets. On Capitol Hill is saying, what are we doing here? And that's because the majority of America is insulated from the consequences. And that, to me, is very unfortunate. If I could just put a ending comment on this, Sarah, for a moment. The 10th Mountain Division in the Army went into Afghanistan just a few years ago, and there were people in that unit on their 9th and 10th combat tour. That unit went into combat, into theater, with therapy dogs, therapists, and quite obviously the medication that goes with that too, to lift people's moods, to help them deal with depression and all the rest. The task that we have put these people to, we are stretching, in my opinion, the ability of humans to cope in these situations beyond anything we've ever experienced in our history as a country, in our military history in particular. Where people are now, the professional military, the all-volunteer military, those that have gone back and back and back and back and forth, including the National Guard now, you know, your reserve and your National Guard units, in the total force concept, they've been fighting as well. And frankly, doing an incredible job. These are incredible people. They're the best we have. But we have stretched these people beyond anything that we have ever seen in war and in our human experience here in this country. And we have, actually, we have 22 suicides a day, Sarah. And that's been going on for a long time. Those that are well-informed in that.
What are, can I ask you a couple questions? I have a friend who's been to war and served over 10 times. What is the rule? Do you know how many times they have a number that they think is mentally what we should, you know, the mental limit on how many times somebody should go. Is it like 6, 5?
Sarah, I know a lot of people. I still have contacts on active duty, and I frankly don't know if there's sort of a presumptive limit right now. But just let me say this, too. With this current situation that we're in, the war on terrorism, and I tell people, I want to say this, too, make no mistake, America is at war. We're not acting like it in terms of our public awareness, and most people wouldn't want to think we are. But I promise you, the people on the other side of the equation, these Islamic terrorists, they absolutely are at war with us. And so therefore, those special operations units, Sarah, we don't know precisely how many tours those people have, but it is beyond belief. And even the suicide rate in special operations unit has climbed high. The divorce rates and all that goes with it, all that is there. Now, there is no end in sight for our special operators. These are the best we have. And so they go and they come back, they go and they come back, they go and they come back. This conflict is a theocratic conflict. We've known nothing like it in the history of America. It knows no borders and it knows no end. This battle, Sarah, in my opinion, is going to be going on for decades ahead. America is going to remain at war in some capacity. It's going to go on for years and years and years. Long after you and I are cold and in the grave, it's going to be going on. So this is an issue that America needs to become much more aware of and realize that we're in a fight and it's going to continue for a very long time.
Well, we have 22 people a day committing suicide. How many did it used to be? How far up has that come? It's a terrible issue.
I became aware of it. Just let me say this. I became aware of it about 4 or 5 years ago, and it was at that rate then. The people that I know that are deeply involved in this, I've heard as many as 33 a day, actually, as opposed to 22.
Because it's being underreported.
Sorry?
It's being underreported.
I think so. And, you know, I'll be very honest. There are a lot of people that serve in this space. The VA, I receive health care at the VA, and I've had very good care and treatment there. There are a lot of people there in a very tough situation trying to do the best they can. Obviously, there are issues. But the figures that I just gave you, the 22 a day, that figure comes from the VA. And do I think personally that figure may be somewhat underreported? Yes, I do. I do. But I've heard as much as 33 a day. But suffice it to say, over the course of this conflict that's been going on, we climbed to that level. It's supposedly been at that level for a number of years. I think the further down that road we go, I'm concerned about the special operators, those fine men and women that I was able to serve alongside. It's going to continue to be a problem, Sarah, and it's most unfortunate, extremely unfortunate. These are the best we have.
And the volunteer military feeds the problem because the whole culture now, it's hidden. And do you think they did that on purpose after the Vietnam War, or do you think it just was a consequence of the anger?
Well, I think it was a combination of a couple of things. The disrepute that the military was held under, and that translated into a failure for the Army, certainly, the larger services. I'm a Marine. For them to be able to meet recruiting goals and in strength for personnel. It wasn't happening. So, and in response to coming out of that war, the effort was to downsize, as we would say in business, to downsize our military, to take the service support units. These are, you know, your logistical units, units such as that, personnel units, maintenance units, and put those missions over onto the reserve and guard, and then really boil it down. Over time, some of the functions in the military were subcontracted out to vendors, like mess halls, things of this nature. And if you go around bases today, you'll see that there are contract guards that are on the gates of the military now. No longer are they people that are in military uniform there. These are contractors. So the whole idea was to put as much money as we could, given the assets that we had, to putting people in uniform, but going to an all-volunteer military, the numbers were going to be far less. They were focused on what they viewed as quality. The recruiting goal went to, over time, the enlistees had to have a minimum high school degree, which wasn't the case in Vietnam, for instance. The result is we got to a very effective, very professional military overall, but it did not represent and does not represent a cross-section of America in terms of our socioeconomic strata. When we went to the all-volunteer military, the middle, upper middle, and you know, most economically blessed segments of our American population virtually stepped out of the military and became not involved. That is most unfortunate, in my opinion. I'm a Norman Schwarzkopf kind of guy when it comes to a notion about national service, and I believe we desperately need national service. Schwarzkopf was of the view that when we say national service, it means more than just military service. That the young people coming out of high school could have a choice. They could go into public service. They could go into public health, they could go into the Peace Corps, the Job Corps, military, but serve 2 years. It's a it's an important concept, I believe, because we talk about getting to know one another and appreciating one another in terms of our ethnicity and our backgrounds, et cetera, et cetera. That's one thing you do in the military. You level all that out, and I promise you in combat, your skin color, whether or not you have a degree, whether or not you're from Yale or Illinois, University of Illinois, or you're from the East Coast or the West Coast, none of that matters whatsoever.
It doesn't matter at all. You don't care.
It's no difference.
You want the best person around. Well, the level, the competence factor becomes a heck of a lot more important.
It's, you know, you learn in combat, you know, I told people this, Sarah, you don't fight for God, Mom, and apple pie or the flag. You fight for one another. Your brother or sister is who's on your right and left, plain and simple. And when you have had that experience, the worst thing you ever want to do or you could ever conceive of is that you would never want to put another human being into that situation. It should be the last possible alternative for our nation to go to war. Any veteran that's been in combat to any extent would be the first to tell you that war is an awful thing, and you would never want to put somebody through it. But the problem is, those people in our country who have the most influence on Capitol Hill as to whether or not that will happen, their children are not involved, nor are most of the children of those in high elected office in our country. And that's unfortunate.
Well, if anybody with power, a lot of the people in leadership positions in this country do not have children in the military, whether it's in Congress, whether it's in business, whether it's in any type of influence. It's not their children because it's a voluntary army. And the people that volunteer typically are the ones that don't have, they feel that's a way for them to move up in the world, right? I mean, a lot of times, or they have a special need or want to give back to the country.
You're exactly right, Sarah. It needs to be, if you don't have skin in the game, that is to say, the loss of your child, a loved one, then war is theoretical. And I'm not saying that people in Capitol Hill, the senators, the congresspeople, that they're not thoughtful about the process. But it's a whole different concept, Sarah. If you know in the pit of your stomach that your son or a daughter is going into a combat zone and may not come out alive, now you are very concerned about, number one, should we be there? And number two, what is happening over there? And how is this whole thing being managed? That's the reality of combat. And too much of America, in fact, the majority of America, are completely insulated. As you and I are talking right now, somebody somewhere wearing the uniform of our country is either shooting or being shot at right now. And I don't see a TV show about it. I see nothing on the news. I didn't read anything about it. And oh, by the way, you know, who's playing in the football game this weekend?
Well, people don't want to see it. I mean, being honest, people don't want to see it. It's a hard thing to watch. But if your children were involved, you'd be watching. You'd be really engaged.
I believe, Sarah, there's nothing more important going on, frankly, than who is out there, you know, defending our country and our way of life so that you and I can be having conversations like this. Freedom is not free. It never has been, and it never will be. Unfortunately, the history of the world, I had a guy tell me the other day that that history doesn't repeat itself, but people repeat history. And I believe that's absolutely the case. So we've got people out there that have sacrificed so that you and I can have freedom of speech and all these things. People are going to continue to have to step up. It's up to a very informed electorate to be involved in that decision-making process, Sarah, in my view, as to where are we going to have to go do these things that we put our men and women in uniform at risk, and where are we going and why are we doing it?
But this won't change. I mean, being honest, this won't change while it's a volunteer military. It just won't, because they don't have, maybe it will. Maybe that half a percent, and there's enough of a problem now where people are starting to speak up. But the majority of the people, like you said, are insulated. So how can, I mean, at what point can they stop stretching these people where they're just going to fall? Like, our soldiers just can't handle it anymore.
Well, I think we're there, and I think we're past that point, frankly, in a lot of situations. Again, it's just that so few people serve, Sarah. I think it's less than 0.5 of 1%, might even be 0.2 to 1% of the American population actually serve. So we're in World War II, everybody knew somebody that had fought or were in uniform serving our country. Nowadays, it's very common to find people that have never talked to a person who has been in the military or serving or have served or at risk and in combat. That's very common now. So again, people are insulated from the cost of war, the sacrifices that are involved.
So are we at a point where we have to do a non-volunteer, we might have to do a draft in general, just because the people that are out there have been stretched so thin that it's just not going to work?
Well, let me approach it this way. I was in the Marine Corps for 16 years. And I've had some friends that were great Marines and were elevated up to the rank of flag grade or general officer. And over the years, I've had some very active conversations with them. One guy in particular, a great officer, a Naval Academy grad, was a two-star general in the Marine Corps, dear friend. He and I were sitting around at his home out in Maryland some years ago, and I was going on, and we were batting things back and forth, and I made the case that the all-volunteer military was unfortunate, and the reasons why, and that is that the vast majority of people that can influence decision-makers in D.C. are completely insulated from the process. And I told him, he said, "Oh, Lynn, you know, you're a dinosaur." I mean, you know, what he was saying was the implements of war, the technology, are so different from when he and I were fighting in Vietnam. We were both lieutenants in the infantry, recon is an infantry unit too, and my buddy was in a straight Marine infantry unit. He says, "It's so different from that." He said, "You know, we want people that want to be in the military." And I said, my buddy, I said, "I know what you're saying, and I understand why you're saying it. But what you're missing is this. We need people in uniform that don't want to be in uniform. We need to have that element of dissent. So that's how you keep the dog on the leash." Now, this wasn't a popular point of view, I think, in my buddy's mind. But you know, we were going back and forth
to
about
be able
this.
To look at the realities and to look at it for in a light that is objective. You need everybody to have a little bit of skin in the game, and right now people don't have the skin in the game. So our culture, American people, are just not engaged like we need them to be.
Sarah, the comparison. I read a lot of history, and I've read a lot of military history, and I've read a lot of Roman history. The beginning of the end for Rome, in my opinion, and that of other people, was when national service became something that you could have someone else do, that you didn't have to do it. It used to be part of Roman citizenship that you had to serve in the military. You had to sacrifice for the military. It was important. And it also gave you not only the experience and the leadership and all the rest of that, but it gave you standing to move on to high political office, etc. Over time, it got to the point where Romans weren't serving in the military, not anywhere close to the numbers they used to be, and they actually hired the duty out to mercenary armies in the far-flung reaches of the realm. And then it all went downhill from there. Now, I'm going to say something here, but I want to make this point. We have an outstanding military. The capabilities of our equipment, our personnel, I believe it's the best we've ever had. Taking nothing away from the service and sacrifice of our patriots that have gone on before, this is a very small, selective military that we have now. One could make the argument that we have a reasonably well-paid mercenary military now fighting for the United States of America. In other words, we do not have the average day-to-day citizen from the wealthiest down to the least wealthy serving in ranks in our military. When we do that, we lose the awareness that our population needs to have to be able to weigh in with our elected representatives and saying, you know what, not so fast. Not so fast. Hold on. Tell me again, why do we need to go over there and do what the military does, Sarah? Bottom line is, the military exists to kill people and break things. That's what they are trained to do, and the bottom line is they need to be able to do that. And our military can do that extremely well. The issue then becomes, where do we do it, when do we do it, and why do we do it? And I want healthy dissent in America so that we can have a very, very thorough discussion right up front instead of getting all lathered up and all emotional and say, okay, we're going to go over there, we're going to kick these people's behinds. Not so fast. That's not how it works.
Yeah, you wouldn't be so you wouldn't be so ape-like if your kid was going there. We're going to beat them up. But you wouldn't act like that if your son was the one on the line. You wouldn't be acting like you were this tough guy anymore.
My first response anymore is when I hear we're getting ready to go in and really get after people. I want to say to the senators and representatives, where are your kids right now? And if they're at Harvard or Yale, pull them out. Pull them out. We'll train them up in the Marine Corps. We'll give them a rifle, put them in the very front ranks of our infantry, and say to these senators and congressmen, now let's do this thing. Let's get it on. We're ready. Let's strap it on, get in there, and kick those people, kick their behind. Are you ready, Senator? Are you ready, Congressperson? Let's go. I think we would probably find ways to look at all the alternatives to war a whole lot more than we would otherwise. Don't you think so, Sarah?
Well, it would change the whole dynamic. But I want to get back on the issue that our current soldiers are not doing so well mentally because they've been on way too many missions at this point that a human being can handle. So what are, it sounds like we're in a point where we're not going to be able to just keep going like this. Is it something that's being addressed, or, you know, what's going on? How are we going to deal with this?
Where the, Sarah, the, you had, right now, you know, I'm not in the decision-making capacity, obviously, to say that, well, this is how they're currently looking at it. I know that we're continuing to deploy, and we have people at risk, advisors, et cetera, and certainly our special operations units are actively engaged, have been actively engaged in many more places than you and I would ever conceive of, frankly, other than the Middle East. They're out there, and they're doing the job. Nobody is asking, to my knowledge, well, put it another way, what you and I are trying to get our arms around here is not common discussion in the public arena. People aren't saying, well, about our special operators. I mean, so what's the rate of suicide there and divorce, and how are they really doing? These are the cream of the crop. My goodness. How much longer is this going to be going on? It just goes on. It just goes on. The deployment of our special operators, Sarah, it's not directed in all cases by the military. It's directed by the Special Operations Unit of the CIA. And there we have people that are deployed around the world doing missions that, frankly, their military branches don't even know about it. Why? There's no need to know. They're down there at SOCOM. They are deployed operationally, you know, by our CIA, and off they go to fight and do whatever they're supposed to do. And a lot of people don't even know about it, including senior officers in their service branch. This war on terrorism is a whole different kettle of fish. It involves more than just large units facing off against one another. That's less the case, and will be the less the case, the longer this war on terrorism goes along. And I'm not implying that the people that make the decisions, you know, in this case the CIA Special Operations Unit and people like that, that these aren't outstanding people. They are. And they're doing their level best to protect this country, and thank God for it. We just need people involved at all levels of our socioeconomic strata being informed and asking informed questions. Where are we? Why are we doing it? And for what purpose?
But I would think that from running the military, they are getting to a point where they're stretching these people so much that they know if they're sending in therapists and they're sending in therapy dogs and they're sending in medications, they know we're stretching this military. So there has to be, they know they're at a cracking point. They have to. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been sending in all this other support staff. So
they do.
And if that's a normal, now, if that's normal part of their mission, they know that they're at a cracking point. So it'll be interesting to watch that.
Well, we're watching the numbers. Like I said, you and I, we see the tail end of it. And those are the people out here that are outstanding individuals that have gotten to the point where they think, you know what, this hurts too much. I don't want to do this anymore. And they end their lives. That is a clear indicator.
Can we talk about that? What is the reality that these soldiers face that they get to that point? I know that if they're being deployed in a non-combat area, that's one thing. But when they're in a combat area, what are they experiencing? And what are they experiencing when they come back that they get to a point where they want to end their lives? And they're ending it in droves.
Mm-hmm. Boy, Sarah.
I know this is a hard thing to talk about, but, you know... Sometimes you got to talk about the hard stuff so people understand.
A lot can be said about this. Like I said, the experience of combat is tough. It's life-changing. I tell people combat wrinkles the brain. You feel old far beyond your years. When I came back from Vietnam, I was 22 years old chronologically, and I felt like I had an 82-year-old brain. I was tired. I felt old. I felt there was no more innocence. No more youthful energy, gone, and gone never to return. Combat gives you a perspective. There's no crucible like it, nothing like it. I would have to say to you, too, that, you know, it can be incredibly boring and incredibly exhilarating. almost all in the same time period, as it goes. Combat can make you an adrenaline junkie, something that people have not always appreciated, even in the military. You do those kinds of things, and it's incredibly moving to your spirit and who you are. It's one of the reasons why, frankly, I would just say this as an aside, motorcycle accidents in the people that come back and from combat units, and they rotate back out and they come back to the States. A lot of these young men and women, they'll get these high performance motorcycles. And when I was in California working not long ago, you see them ripping up and down the Pacific Coast Highway, you know. Well, we now know from mental health practitioners that the high that one can get when you're firing down the road on a motorcycle, going in and out, doing those things, it's the closest approximation to that adrenaline high that you can get in combat that there is. And while I think some of these young men, probably most of them, wouldn't even understand that connection, the connection exists. You come back, Sarah, and you've gone through a great deal. You are changed. The person that went over is not the person that came back. That person that went over doesn't exist anymore. And so you're back now, and you're trying to fit in. You're trying to, quote-unquote, be normal, whatever that is. You're trying to find your lane in life. You're trying to find something that will give your life meaning and effect now that you're out of uniform and all those things that you experienced there, which, by the way, you'll never forget. And the relationships and the friendships are like none other. I tell people that combat fuses people's souls. My dearest friend is Kenny Harrington. He was my point man in my recon unit in Vietnam. Kenny is a tremendous man and a tremendous Marine. And he is my brother. I've got a birth brother. Kenny is my brother. He's my brother from every component part of that word you can consider or think of. Kenny was born in the Bronx, raised in the Bronx. I was raised in downstate Illinois. Kenny is black and I am white. We're writing a book together on the black-white issue in America and what we experienced fighting in some pretty desperate situations in Vietnam and how we became friends and the fact that we are best friends. I Kenny loves me and I love him. He's my brother.
It's kind of like Bubba Gump. I mean, I'm, you know,
big
making
time.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bubba Gump on steroids, I would say. We're talking recon Marines here, special operators, but, you know, You have gone through a very cathartic experience, and you come back, and now what am I going to do? Now, because so few serve in the military now, it's very easy for these young men and women to slip through the cracks. Now, HR people these days in companies are not going to say, oh, my God, if that person was a special operator, if that person was in the infantry, oh, my gosh, if they were really out there shooting and being shot at, do we really want that person working here in our company? They'll never say that. But do I think that that's a factor? I know it is a factor. My point being here is that the term you hear now is companies, oh, we want to hire veterans, we're veteran-friendly. Sarah, do you know what veterans refer to that phrase as, veteran-friendly? They call it happy talk, because it is happy talk. The a lot of these young
because it's just not real. I mean,
it's not real.
They say that, but it's basically saying we're an equal employment company, and
Sarah,
then they don't even.
It's PC. It's PC language, and nothing other than that. Now, are there companies out there that do care? Yes. Are there? And that's a function of leadership. That means the leader cares. But in the main, it isn't happening. And so, again, these people are trying to find where they fit in. I've come to believe, let me just say this too, and get on with their lives. But when they fall through the cracks, if you can't get a job, if you can't feed your family, if you feel like nobody cares, and one last component part, no fear of death, after a while, when that last flicker of hope goes out, Sarah, the world can get very dark. And then that's when I think people do the ultimate way that they can remove pain. They grab a weapon, they put it to their temple, and they're done. There's no more pain.
Do they think that they're
most
betrayed?
Unfortunate.
Do they feel betrayed by our country and the people, by us when they come home? Do they feel betrayed by everyone? They can't relate to their neighbor. The country doesn't seem to care about them. Is that how they feel? Even though people think they do and they thank the veterans and they stand up and clap, that's all surface stuff, right? Because if they can't get a job and they can't, we're not really supporting them. And then it really makes them almost angry. Like, I don't even want you to clap for me because it's fake. It's not real.
Yeah. The way you dishonor a warrior is you deny them the dignity of their experience, Sarah. And that is the low water mark of that in our country was Vietnam, of course. But it's going on today. It's disrespect of a different sort. And nobody is out in the street protesting Vietnam veterans or, you know, giving them, you know, flipping them off with the middle finger salute, things of that nature was going on in the Vietnam era. That's not happening. But, you know, if they can't get jobs, if people won't seriously want to recruit them and retain them, these are outstanding people.
Why can't they get jobs? Is it because they don't feel that they have the skill set to what's going on?
Well, like I said, it's very easy for these people to become isolated after a while, too, you know, because there's so few of them relative to the larger population base that serve. So, you know, if they can't get meaningful job opportunities, it's easy for them to retreat and to become caught off and alone, and that's when that downward spiral can really, really gain momentum. Let me just say this to you. Here's a way of saying it, I think, that can add some perspective. In the 9 years following World War II, Sarah, 50% of surviving veterans went into business for themselves. Now, granted, it's a different economy right now and a different time and place, and everybody knew somebody, right? So, you know, there was, a much more of a community, family, nation involvement that, well, thank you for the great cause. Let's get you a degree. Let's get you a job. Let's move this thing forward. But interestingly, 50% of those people ended up in business for themselves. Now, I think that's very instructive. When you are a person that's seen a lot of combat, I don't know if you're going to be the type of person that's going to go into, say, PepsiCo and, you know, bump your way up through the corporate chain to get to a senior leadership position. Put another way, they're not in the business of kissing any portion of a boss's persona, whether it's a ring, a hand, or anything else.
Well, different things matter now, right? They don't care about all that stuff anymore. They're also very independent. They're willing to go out and do what it takes to get things done. They just see life differently, right? They think more like an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurs go through, I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. Entrepreneurs can go through some pretty tough situations, and it kind of gets you to some of those same levels. I would never say that it's like being at war, but I used to say this has to be sort of like it because people are trying to destroy you. You're always on the brink of losing everything you have. It's not like being shot at, but you do grow in ways that are enormous that sometimes you can't relate to people as well.
Well, good point, Sarah. Being in business for yourself involves risk, real risk, and it's not for the faint-hearted, is it? I know you know that. It's not. Well, these are people that have been to combat. They've served and sacrificed. These are, as I said, some of the very best people we have. They have all that it takes to be successful business people. They are motivated. They are team players. They are loyal to a fault. They are persistent. These are, and they're smart. They're smart. They're quick learners. So that's why, by the way, you have programs now across the land that we feed into, like the Syracuse program. The Syracuse University of Veterans program is, I think, the best in the country. You've got the Bunker Labs down here in Chicago and now expanded out around the country where you have what they call boots to business curriculums, mini MBA programs. Where people, veterans come in and they're encouraged to consider being in business for themselves and what that all means and putting together a business plan and having your business plan Shark Tank. where my organization feeds into that, my day-to-day life, is all that is well and good, but it doesn't help if you cannot get operating capital to get your business off the ground. And for the junior enlisted personnel in our military, the ones that do the heavy lifting in combat, virtually impossible to get any investment capital, operating capital, so you can get your business off the ground. The only way a veteran can pretty much do that right now is if, number one, your officer corps, by and large, they'll figure out a way. Your senior enlisted, sergeant majors and first sergeants, they'll figure out a way. But the young enlisted people that come in and serve a term and go in and slug it out in combat and then come back out, it's virtually impossible for them. So my organization got involved, and we've had some coverage, but we're working to get the GI Bill modified so that the veterans, if they're so inclined, they can tap into that allotment, take a loan at a very low interest rate. We just got a law passed in Illinois where we're going to provide operating capital loans for veteran businesses in the state of Illinois, veterans that are Illinois residents and will establish and set up their business in Illinois. There is a due diligence criteria they've got to go through, but they've got the opportunity and they have to have operating capital, and that doesn't exist. Sarah, it's 2016. For goodness sake, I'm not a very bright man, but sometime I'm stunned at the notion that, hasn't anybody thought about this before? What's going on here?
I think it gets back to our culture of only having less than, half a percent that are serving. That's not in the top of our minds. We're just a different culture right now. And I think that's why we need people like you to bring this awareness. But I want to talk about past societies and battles. You brought up the Romans. And even the Crusades, they had a purification process for soldiers to heal when they arrived home. And they understood that soldiers needed something and needed help. Are we doing that? And I think what you're doing is a big part of that. But are we, besides people like you, are we doing that in general?
No. There's a very interesting book called What It Feels Like to Go to War. The author is the guy that wrote this book called Matterhorn. It was a best-selling, New York Times best-selling book. And this gentleman here was an Ivy League guy who volunteered to go into the Marine Corps, did so, was a Navy Cross recipient in Vietnam, came back, and then tried to fit in and really went through a difficult time in fitting in. And he wrote this book. It took him 46 years, I believe, to get this thing out of him. When he did, he wrote it. It was incredible. In this book, the author was talking about, he said, when I came back, I just wish that I would have had in his case, he said, a girlfriend who loved me that would have put me into a hot tub and just washed me clean. When I read that, I'll tell you, I started tearing up, had to put the book down. And I felt myself saying, absolutely right. Absolutely right. Clean me, cleanse me, refresh me so I can start over. Societies, as you mentioned before, other societies absolutely had a cleansing process. Native American culture in America. When you talk about understanding warrior culture, boy, do they ever get it in spades. They absolutely do. There was a process whereby a young man became a brave, and it always involved physical privation and sacrifice. You had to make the cut, and it wasn't easy. And likewise, and by the way, what was their role? Their role was to defend the tribe, to stand in the gap on behalf of all the tribe, to do that, and they did that. But when they would come back from their battles, there would be a cleansing process. Let me give an example. There was one tribe I remember reading about where the warrior would stand up one at a time in a circle, and there would be concentric circles out from the warrior of the people in the tribe. And he would tell his story. The first circle nearest him would then turn around and tell his story to the next circle behind them. And then they would turn around and tell the story to the circle behind them. And so forth, until everybody in the tribe had told his story. because now it's their story. So important. One of the men in my unit in Vietnam was a guy named Dallas Whitewing. He was a Ho-Chunk Indian, Native American, and he was a radio operator in one of the other teams. We had 6 six-man teams. Dallas wasn't my radio operator. He was one of them. He invited me up to a ceremony years ago, and I went up to it not knowing anything about it. He just said, "Hey, come on up. I want to show you something, and I want you to see this, and maybe be a part of it if you'd like to be." I went up, and it was that very kind of thing. He brought me down into the middle of this circle and introduced me to the tribe and who I was, and then asked me to say a few words, and I did. And they gave me a Pendleton blanket, which is like a symbol of being welcomed into the tribe. And then they had this ceremony where they would beat, they had these drums. And Native American people believe that those drums that you've seen in movies, that they are actually a living, breathing entity. And so it's a big deal. So they beat these drums rhythmically, and they sing in the way that Native Americans sing, and you've heard it in movies like Dances with Wolves and all that. It's amazing. They believe that when that happens, that the ancestors, the warriors who have fought before, come and congregate. And then you come out into the circle, and they have this little dance that they go through. And even as uncoordinated as I am, I could do it. And so with another Ho-Chunk warrior, you go side by side, and then other warriors come in, and you're going around in this circle. And all I can tell you is, it was like time stood still. And people from the tribe, men, women, kids, would come out into the circle and grab my hand and say, "Thank you." I'm telling you, I found myself thinking, oh my God, I wish everybody that served in our military, that had gone through combat in particular, could go through this, could experience this kind of homecoming, if you will. In that tribe, the first group of people that are consulted with in every single decision are the warriors. They are respected for what they did then, and they're respected for what they are and who they are now. And I tell people, Veterans Day once a year? No. It should be Veterans Day every day in America. Every day should be Veterans Day. That's how you honor warriors. You respect them. In terms of practical day-to-day honoring in America, get them a decent job. Buy them a beer. Say, "Hey, listen, appreciate what you did. Now let's get you a job and let's move on and get them moving."
And also be thoughtful about not sending more into war unless we really feel that the war is... We have to value their lives. We have to value this whole process. Right? I mean, it's all-encompassing. And the reason why they're so respected is because people realize how awful it is and that we really need it. And thank you so much for the sacrifice. But we're not going to be sending people into war because we know how bad it is and we know what the sacrifice is. Right now, we don't understand the sacrifice. So that's why we keep going. That's why we don't thank them. And that's why we keep sending them, because we don't understand that sacrifice.
We don't know how to do it. We're clumsy and awkward and ineffective at it, generally speaking, Sarah. This Wages of War book that I mentioned, there was a book called Wages of War. A friend of mine gave it to me and said, if you're going to be out talking about receiving veterans home in America, you need to read this book. A very well written book by 2 university professors. It covered the time span from the Revolutionary War to about 8 years past Vietnam. And when you start reading how our Revolutionary War soldiers were received back, the War of 1812, the Civil War, oh my gosh, the no welfare system existing, you know, nothing like, no, I shouldn't say welfare, no VA system existing, anything like that. These, we've had warriors that have sacrificed greatly, been wounded. Their families have sacrificed greatly. And, you know, the things we have put these people through, and we are still I think people are trying. Some people are trying very hard. The VA is a very important concept. It has issues. It has issues because we need people involved in oversight and all the rest of that. It's an ongoing commitment. Look, Sarah, the way I look at it is, when a person takes their oath of enlistment to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, that's what it is, to the Constitution of the United States, against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to obey the lawful orders of those officers appointed me, et cetera, et cetera. That oath basically means, too, that if called upon, they are willing to sacrifice their life for our way of life so that we can go on. Then that's a very, very significant commitment, no greater commitment, in fact. And so they're deserving of our respect, and they're deserving of opportunity when they come back. And just let me finish by saying, they're not asking for a freebie. They're not asking for anything like that. They just want an opportunity to compete on an even playing field for the American dream. That's why I'm a big believer, Sarah, in entrepreneurship. I for those veterans that are so inclined, I really want them to have the opportunity to have their own business, to aspire, have their piece of the American pie, hire more veterans, create more opportunity. We need a small business resurgence in America, Sarah, and why not the veteran? They deserve a seat at that table.
Well, how do people get hold of you? Because you have a good thing going on. What do we need to do? I'll put your information on the radio page. And what is your website so people know how to get hold of you?
Well, we got a Facebook page right now, and it's just the number one, Vet at a Time. If they'll just Google One Vet at a Time, they'll go right to our Facebook page. And, you know, my telephone number, I have no problem putting it out. As we're 24/7, as the old saying goes, we doze but never close. It's my number is 630-222-5155. This is what we do, and as we say, no greater duty, no higher honor.
They can call if they need help. You can direct them in different places, whatever, to help them go.
Yes, we promote entrepreneurship, and we also operate really as a clearinghouse if a veteran needs help with a VA, we get them into the right spot. They need a wing person helping them. Disabled American veterans do a great job advocating for them. The VFW, American Legion, other service organizations like that, Marine Corps League, they have people assigned to help these veterans navigate through the wickets of the VA. That's sometimes the most daunting aspect of getting help within the VA. Once you're in the system and you're part of it, I mean, I've had very good health care with the VA, and I defended doctors for 20 years as a trial lawyer. I'm not a doctor, but I think I have got a pretty good eye for what is competent medical care, and I've had some outstanding doctors that I've worked with over at Heinz VA Hospital here in Illinois. Truly, really good people. So, in any event, I am reachable at that number, and people can contact me at that Facebook page. And just let me say this too, Sarah. Thank you for the opportunity to come on here and to speak about honoring our veterans. These are wonderful, outstanding people. And thank you for having the heart to care. If we have people like you that want to dig in on these issues and ask the questions and help where they can, have a willing heart to help, it goes a long way towards healing these veterans in the coming back process.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you coming on the show today. I think this is an important issue. So I hope you have a great rest of your day, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah. Bye-bye.
And that's all we have for today. I want to remind you that I have a new ebook that's out called Wrong Side of History. It, again, is really important information about Assad. I have Senator Richard Black talking about his letter that he wrote, and he's spent every day for the last 7 years researching Syria. He was the chief prosecutor, the chief counsel, if you will, for the Pentagon for years. He was a JAG officer. His expertise was Africa and the Middle East. Very experienced, very knowledgeable about that area. I think that you will learn a lot from that book. I also, my video, my podcast with his interview is up there as well. That's free. And if you can't afford the book, can't afford the ebook, send me an email. I'll send it to you for free. It's not that I'm trying to make money here. I'm just trying to cover my costs. But if you can't afford it, be sure to send me an email and I'll send you the ebook for free. So for now, I hope everybody has an amazing rest of the day.